All
right, so I'm going to start. There are indeed three of us. This was my way of avoiding doing all the work on short notice. So I thank Bennett Link and Martin Van Kirkwijk for allowing me to twist their arms the day after my arm was twisted by David. We are going to try to summarize, in some sense, what's happened in the field in the last 4 months. I gave the Blackboard lunch actually 4 months ago today, or September, so I guess 3 months ago. And that mostly what's happened in that time that can be summarized well to the diverse audience is actually the tremendous progress in observations. We've done a lot of theoretical work. Most of that, there'll be some bits of theory you see, but actually most of what you're going to see are defining problems that have been defined by the observations that are going to now force most of us to keep ourselves quite busy for the next, for quite a while. So the timing of the program was good. And you'll see a bit of theory, but mostly you're going to see discussions of observational things that have been talked about here, that have been done by people that were here for the program, and some of the work was focused or brought to fruition here. So what I need to first do is define for you a little bit, just very briefly, because I've done this already for some subset of this crowd, what we mean by young, and what we mean by young in this context is in some sense motivated by the energy sources. And as I go through in my sort of broad brush introduction, I'll fill in these boxes, which are object on this axis and source of energy that allows us to see them on this axis. Okay? And as you'll see, there's some boxes checked, some not checked. One could ask about adding other columns here. So not all energy sources, you'll notice, are listed. I don't list chemical nor nuclear energy. And of course, the objects, let me tell you the first thing to say is that there are about 10 to the 9 neutron stars in our galaxy. Astronomers are not nearly doing so well. They've only seen about 1,000 out of those. So there are many, many more objects to be found, and the census has not even been taken. So let me start by just writing down a few things that are going to come up over and over again, which is the reminder of the by far the simplest bit of physics that allows us to actually study in great detail, and you'll hear about recent progress here on the majority of this population, which are the radio pulsars, the objects most of you, all of you probably know about, that are very, in some sense, old hat. And what do they do? Well, they lose their rotational energy via a magnetic dipole, just the fact that the dipoles misalign as they rotate. And that means there's an energy loss, E dot, which is minus twice mu squared, where mu is the magnetic moment, omega to the fourth, where omega is the spin frequency, sine squared theta, that's the angle between the dipole and the spin axis, 3c cubed. And of course, you just set this to I omega omega dot. Namely, the loss of energy, the source of that energy is a rotation. So the simple, trivial thing to point out here is this is really the box that was first checked in the box that we've been studying for quite a while. Objects tapping rotation, in this case, via the magnetic dipole. Okay, what does this predict? And that's one thing I'll briefly talk about. This would predict that omega dot should be proportional to omega cubed. Okay? These are, in some cases, both observable, and so you can ask, as the object changes its spin frequency, which you can monitor, does the omega dot actually go like omega cubed? Okay? Namely, is this story have hold any water whatsoever? Okay? Because we use it and abuse it all the time to take an omega dot and an omega and infer a magnetic dipole. Okay? So let me just tell you right now that there has been progress on this. There have already been multiple measurements. Of just a few young neutron stars gave this thing, let's just set this equal to n, that's what you observe, some, it's called the breaking index, n. And old measurements of a few gave a few values of n that basically range from something like 2.0 to about 2.5. Let me just remind you, if it were gravitational wave emission, say if the star has some deformation, this would be omega to the fifth. So you'd measure n equals phi. So it's already been ruled out that this is gravity wave. Okay. This is an outstanding puzzle that was discussed quite a lot at this program. Why in the world are these things spinning a little bit less steeply? Let me at least point out that finally there's one that obeys the law. So there is one. Okay. So if you wait long enough, and I'm not even going to bother giving you the call numbers. It doesn't matter for this audience. But let me just say, there is a brand new result that is Canillo et al. It was actually just here last week. And there is a pulsar with n of 2.9 plus or minus about 0.1. Does anybody, I don't remember.
Slightly less.
Slightly less, okay. So let me just say n of 2.9. Okay. So somewhat reassuring in the sense that at least there are some pulsars. This is a different radio pulsar than these measurements have been made, where actually you start to see something like this. So, for most of the radio pulsars, again, as I said, we're going to use this to infer the magnetic fields. Okay. You measure omega, omega dot, we roughly know enough about the neutron stars that we don't have to argue about the moment of inertia, and we'll do that. So I'll get to that in a moment. That's one energy source. For these same neutron stars, you can also actually see this energy source. You can see the thermal content, the fact that the neutron star, when it's born, is very hot. And this manifests itself as thermal emission. And you can't actually see this. So let me briefly talk about thermal emission. This is in some sense, too. So the neutron star is born quite hot. Temperature's more than 10 to the 11 Kelvin. And cools for the first roughly million years by neutrino emission. Okay, so the core is cooling via neutrino emission. And as I'll show you the observations of the thermal emission for this, but I just want to tell you it is an energy source. It's something we've observed. And it's actually telling us some things which I'll discuss, which are pretty interesting. There's another energy source, and this is one that will be talked about mostly by Martin, which is the magnetic field itself. Okay, this used to be a question mark. Can you somehow tap the magnetic field as a source of energy? And I think the answer now is more like that, exclamation point. Indeed, you can. It's quite dramatic, and it's something Martin will discuss. Let me give you a sense of, let me just say. So there are, of order, 9 objects we know of. These are both the soft gamma repeaters, objects that have large outbursts. These are ones that I discussed last time. The recent outburst of one of these substantially modified the Earth's ionosphere. And another set of objects which have a funny name, anomalous X-ray pulsars. I don't want to really belabor this. Martin will talk about it, but I just want to let you know there are two classes of objects for which, definitely for this class, we're pretty confident we see them because of their release of magnetic energy. Okay. In this, these objects, we think it's both a combination of this and this. And I'll discuss for you in a minute why, for these systems, this is the dominant energy source over rotation. I'll show you that in a moment. So what are the typical, what are the relative energy scales? Let me just give you those numbers. Thank you. Okay, so the rotational energy content is, of course, just 1/2 I omega squared, and that's about 2 by 10 to the 50 ergs, if you're spinning at 10 milliseconds. What's the magnetic energy? That's, of course, just something like B squared over 8 pi times the volume of the star. And that's a number like about 10 to the 48 ergs for a large field of 10 to the 15 gauss squared. And the thermal energy, well, the thermal energy is mostly the heat capacity of the neutrons, which make up the majority of the neutron star. So it is still aptly named, we think. And that's just the heat capacity of a degenerate gas. So that's roughly something like that times T over T Fermi. Fermi energy for the neutrons is about 100 MeV. That's their Fermi energy. So this ends up being about 10 to the 47 ergs. T over 10 to the 9 squared. Okay. So I want to write these down for you because I want to talk about stars where these inequalities can be flipped. Okay? So you can see clearly that the rotational energy content, for that to be bigger than the magnetic energy content, which has really always been the case, the inequality you need is that B is less than about 10 to the 13 gauss if you're rotating very, let's say even slowly at 10 seconds. Okay? So that's just those inequalities. Let me show you the first figure, which is showing for a large fraction of the radio pulsars their spin periods and their period derivatives, p dot as opposed to omega dot. Okay. This is a very busy plot. It has a lot of data on it. The generic vanilla radio pulsars, the 10 to the, are typically one, rotating at 1 second with a field. Here's a 10 to the 12 gauss line, 10 to the 12 gauss. Okay. So this is period derivative, spin period. So here's 1 millisecond, here's 1 second. The line, sorry, an object with a constant magnetic field will evolve along a line like this as it spins down. So here's 10 to the 12, 10 to the 13, 10 to the 14 gauss. Also plotted on here are lines of constant age. If you start rotating very rapidly, you will reach this point when you are 1,000 years old, 100,000 years old, or 10 million years old. So the first thing to say is, where is this relation? That's roughly a line like this. Namely, if you're to the right of this line, this green line, your magnetic energy in the star is bigger than the rotational energy. Okay, so if you can tap it, that's the puzzle. There's a large energy source there. Okay, and as you see, there are objects now over on this side of the plot. This was not true 2 years ago. These are the objects that we call soft gamma repeaters or anomalous X-ray pulsars. The fact that they sit in this part of the diagram does tell you that if you want to understand their emission, you better look to the magnetic energy. The rotational energy is not going to do it for you. That's what motivated a lot of the theoretical work. This is a radio pulsar. Okay, this is a radio pulsar. So there are even some radio pulsars now that are getting very high fields. For those of you who worry about things like Landau energies, let me just remind you, the cyclotron energy at 4 by 10 to the 13 gauss is the rest mass of the electron. Okay. So the QED field, you know, is roughly 4 by 10 to the 13. It's a line like this. So all of these objects have magnetic fields at their surface large enough that the Landau levels are of order the rest mass of the electron. Okay. The other point to make is it takes a long time, depending on the magnetic field, it takes you a long time to reach this domain. So if you're a 10 to the 12 gauss field, as you can see, the time it takes you to get over here is actually much, much longer than the age of the universe. Okay? Whereas for higher fields, 10 to the 14 gauss, you see you enter this regime, if you're coming down this line by magnetic spin down, at about 1,000 years. Okay? So it's only the high-field objects that get themselves into this place, if they're born rapidly rotating, within the age of the universe. Okay? All right. So the progress has been twofold, and you're going to hear about this mostly from Martin, the population of this object. So I just want to briefly point out the other progress that's happened is that many of these very young neutron stars have been just added to these plots in the last 2 years. The current youngest neutron star we know of as a radio pulsar is 700 years old. So it's younger than the Crab, the conventional one you all see in the textbooks. And that one's actually not on this plot.
How do we know it's 700?
So, okay, so thanks for asking. What you do is you say, I take the formula I'd erased for E dots as a function of omega dot. If I've measured omega dot and omega, and I presume it was born much more rapidly rotating than it's rotating today, I can integrate back and find when was it at, you just go back, you just integrate back in time and get the initial age. Okay. That depends on that n being 3. Okay. So if n is 3, you can do that, and if n is always 3 and the field doesn't change, that's a perfectly good extrapolation. We know for the Crab that if you play that game, there's a problem. So there is an issue which brings up the possibility that neutron stars, when they're born, might be born very rapidly rotating, 1 or 2 milliseconds, and via some other mechanism, particularly involving gravitational waves, spin down very rapidly, and then thereafter spin down via magnetic dipole radiation. Okay, and that's the topic of R-modes, which was the first month of this program, which is basically hopeless to summarize, and the relativists are chuckling because they know how hard it is to summarize. But there is a possibility there, and that depends on how well the observers can actually say that you know both the breaking index, that n, well enough, and the age of the remnant you actually know. So Crab, we know when the supernova occurred because it was observed, and there was an event observed, so they know the date. Okay, many of these you don't know the date because the remnant is far in the galactic plane and it would have been obscured at that point.
I'm confused. So you integrate back, and how do you know what omega to stop?
No, it's just in the limit that the initial omega is much much faster than the current omega. The thing it converges to a fixed time.
Oh.
Right. It's just the omega cubed. I mean, I should. Okay. So there's a small correction. Right. Okay. Okay. So let me take this down and just talk briefly about progress on these, what I'll sort of call the vanilla radio pulsars. And the major progress, I think, that I'm going to talk about, Bennett will talk about others, is the fact that the Crab is not typical. So unfortunately, the textbook young radio pulsar, the Crab, is not typical. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that if I make a table of the young pulsars less than 1,000 years old, or of order 1,000 years old, the Crab is very unusual. So let me just briefly do that. So if I tell you the pulsar, it's what we call characteristic age. This is this age just from P over P dot. Okay. Its period in milliseconds. Its B field in 10 to the 12 Gauss, and its E dot, the rate at which it's losing energy. Let me give you the names, though it's not going to matter to you. This is the new one that's 700 years old, has a spin period of 325 milliseconds, has a B field that's quite large, of order the critical field, about 5 by 10 to the 13 Gauss, and it has an E dot in units of 10 to the 36 ergs per second of about 7. Here's the Crab, which is 1,300, 33 milliseconds, B field of 4 by 10 to the 12, and a very large deposition rate into the nebula. That's why the Crab Nebula is so bright. So one has to ask if many of these higher field objects have lost a lot of their energy initially, more rapidly, which is why it's spinning slower. So the conjecture is the difference between these two is just the higher field allows it to spin down faster. And so today it's actually not that energetic. I'm just going to give you some of the call numbers. Again, 1,600 years, 150, 15, and again, 18. And the last one, this is the one that had the breaking index measured of 3. is again very high field about the critical field and very wimpy in terms of powering its nebula. There's very little energy loss. So the point is that this was the first one we knew about. Okay, these are ordered in age. And as you can see, it's now clear that it's not the typical object. So again, this is relatively new information. Both this one and this one have only been discovered in the last 9 months, or reported on the last 9 months. So it's a rapidly evolving field, which means the theorists are always way behind. And that, of course, makes it fun, if you don't mind being behind. Okay.
Is there any reason why the crab is different?
No, I think what we're seeing is that I think the general way to state the trend is that if you asked radio pulsar pundits what was a typical magnetic field 5 years ago, they'd say 10 to the 12 Gauss. If you ask today, I think the answer is different. It's that there are a number of them which are 10 to the 13 Gauss, and that really changes things because they're allowed to spin down so much more rapidly at their birth. And there's some that are 10 to the 14 Gauss, which you're going to hear about. So I'd say the big revolution is pushing the magnetic field up a factor of 100, which, as you can see from that plot, allows you to really start having to consider other energy sources, because rotation is very quickly get rid of the rotational energy because the field's so high, you spin down very rapidly.
And is this supposed to be an unbiased sample of young
So short answer is no. The new ones are, a lot of these are found in completely different ways. So this one was found in a radio survey in the galactic plane, where they was tuned to actually handle what's called dispersion of basically the pulse gets dispersed because of propagating through the interstellar medium. This instrument was built to get around that, so you could go deeper into the galaxy. Let me just give you a sense. There's roughly a supernova once every 30 years. So if all of those are making radio pulsars, then we only expect about 30 younger than 1,000 years. Okay, so you'd like to be confident maybe you could take that census. It's already clear that some fair fraction don't become radio pulsars.
Okay. Are all of those associated with supernova remnants?
Sorry, these are all associated with supernova remnants. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Some of which have birth dates because somebody was lucky, crabs nearby. A lot of these other ones are far enough away, I presume, that it was obscure. Though this one, there's a paper by a Chinese paper claiming that there is something in the literature of a reported supernova that dates it. Mm-hmm. Is it this one or this one? One of these two it was discussed here, which I haven't seen the real paper. Okay, let me explain the last.
Mark, yeah. Is the crab's nebula most confined closer to the crab than the other?
Well, a lot of these don't have what you would call. A lot of these don't have what we call the pleron, the piece of the remnant that's due to the energy deposition put in by the radio pulsar. So the crab has that, but some of these other objects don't. So as I said, there's this possibility, which I'm not going to discuss, of gravitational wave emission, of which we have no objects yet. Okay, these would be detected by something like LIGO, that are tapping the rotational energy via gravitational wave emission. And what I want to briefly talk about is thermal emission from the radio pulsars. And this is the ability to go and look in the X-rays and see what is the surface emission from the neutron star that's only, say, 1,000 years old. This has been something that has seen a lot of recent progress, and I just want to leave you with this one and then move on. All right, Bennett, take over. These neutron stars, as I said, the interior is cooling. You should think of it basically as an isothermal core with a thermal blanket on it. That's the outer layer material. That thermal blanket basically sets the amount of radiation coming through and sets the surface temperature. Okay. Now, we don't really know what the composition is of the material on the surface of the neutron star. And what I want to discuss briefly are observations that are starting to give us indications directly that it's not something like iron, which is what the textbooks would tell you. So how do we do that? Well, the way you do that is the following. If it were iron is very opaque at these wavelengths, and so no matter what energy you look at with an X-ray detector, you pretty much always penetrate or see photons coming from nearly the same surface. In that case, you'd expect to see something close to a black body, Now let's take the opposite extreme. Let's say it's pure hydrogen. How much do you need to have this change? Well, you need about 1 gram per square centimeter, or amount of mass of about 10 to the 13 grams, or 10 to the minus 20 solar masses of hydrogen. It would totally change the thermal spectrum. What happens with hydrogen? Well, what happens with hydrogen is that it's a million degrees, it's totally ionized. The main opacity for that material then is basically free absorption. The fact that photons, as they come in, can only be absorbed if there's an electron and a proton interacting simultaneously. That ends up having an opacity that goes like 1 over frequency cubed. So as you look in with higher energies, you actually get to see in deeper into the star. Okay. Now it's an atmosphere, it has a temperature gradient. So if you see in deeper, you see a higher temperature than the temperature defined by the total flux coming out. Okay. Well, that ends up being a very big effect. And let me show you a sense for that. These are plots, theoretical plots, showing that contrast. So this is a 10 to the 6 degree neutron star surface. These are calculations, first of all, and these are not data. I'll show you the punchline in a moment with the data. The data aren't this rich just yet, okay, but they can tell the difference. So a black body curve, so this is energy, this is the spectral flux. A black body curve at a million Kelvin looks like this. Their best guess at iron is this gobbledygook stuff that you see nearly is on top of the black body curve. If you have pure hydrogen, that's the red line. And so what you see is that at high energies, you see a much higher emission. And if you were to measure the curvature of this, you get a different effective temperature. You get a different temperature because you're seeing in deeper. Okay. Well, that allows you to at least say, is the spectrum consistent with, say, hydrogen or black body? And by consistent, what I mean by that is you can fit either. The current data are good enough to allow you to fit a black body or that other spectrum. But of course, in both cases, you get a different radius. And so to decide which you like, you have to use your prior knowledge of the distance to the source. Okay? And the fact that we don't think neutron stars are 2 kilometers. We think they're 10 kilometers. So when you do that, here's what you get. And this is busy. It's my last plot. And I think Martin was right. I was going to go for 30 minutes. This is a busy plot. This shows the surface temperature of the neutron star as a function of age in years. So here's 1,000 years. Here's 1 million years. Ignore these curves. Just look at these curves. These are the theoretical predictions for how the surface temperature should evolve with time. Plotted on, this is from George Pavlov. This is actually, as you can see, I printed out his view graph from the web. He shows here what happens if you fit a black body, you get that temperature. If you fit a realistic hydrogen atmosphere, you get the blue curve, the blue point. And he does this for many different neutron stars. The preferred solution, preferred being where you say we roughly want a 10-kilometer neutron star at the known distance, tells you which solution to take, are then boxed in red. And I think there's two messages from this. The first one is that if you can notice this from even from the back, for basically neutron stars younger than about 10 to the 5 years, the preferred solution is always light elements, hydrogen. It's the preferred solutions of these blue. For longer ages, the preferred solutions, these are not meant to go through these lines. You have to realize this is you put it on the point. You ask later, does it agree with the theory? For the older neutron stars, the preferred solution is iron or something very opaque. That's the first message to take. So there's clearly, I would claim, so this is just new. It's only been about a month since George gave this talk. There's evidence of either differences or some kind of evolution, that the hydrogen that's there somehow goes away. It's also true that if you believe the points in red, there's no one theoretical line that'll go through all these points. And so it might well be that neutron stars are different enough that we won't get some single universal cooling curve. Okay, so I think I better stop there, but first take questions on this stuff, especially from those who don't do it for a living. Yes, Steve.
So the magnetic dipole radiation, if you have any conductivity in the surrounding medium, that's not that important?
In the plasma around the...
Yeah, I mean...
Yes, that comes up. Mostly, for the higher magnetic field objects.
Actually, a little bit more. I think
actually
the conductivity is important, and to some sense, you fill the whole magnetic sphere with plasma. You can ask where does the plasma dominate and where does the magnetic field dominate, which depends then on the rotation rate and so on. And in fact, many of these ends, which are sort of more like 2.5, you can understand from that. So I think the situation is slightly better in that sense than Lars said. But what he didn't mention is that there are two pulsars which have n of 1.5, and there's no way you can understand those. So yes, it is important, and partly it helps, actually. But there's also puzzles, as always.
Yeah. I'm not going to get this out. Stan?
Could it be that the crab almost failed because it's supposed to?
Almost failed in what sense? Almost failed. What?
In other words,
I don't understand that
one. Burst out the way.
Yeah.
And crab didn't.
But, I mean, there is an issue of how much material falls back on the neutron star. Okay, that's always an issue, and that's how we think black holes are made. Some of them are so wimpy when they send out their explosion that they don't unbind the whole envelope, and the envelope falls over and pushes it into a black hole. But I don't think there's no sense of that. I didn't talk at all about where the field comes from. Okay, and the reason is because I think we just don't know.
No, but the crab apparently is losing its energy much faster because the nebula is close.
No. Crab is losing its energy faster because it hasn't had a chance to lose it yet. It was born with a slow. It was born with a smaller magnetic field than these other objects. If I could get this up, right. The field's small.
Okay.
So it still has a lot to lose. In terms of the rotational energy, it hasn't lost it yet. Okay, Bennett. Okay, I'd like to talk about two phenomena which probe the interior physics of the neutron star. One of these is glitches. Glitches are jumps in the spin rate of pulsars. And these are very common in the radio pulsars that Lars mentioned. And I'll discuss a new observation that's really a breakthrough in helping us understand what sort of physics is responsible for this phenomenon. And the second thing I'll talk about is the first clear evidence for precession in an isolated neutron star. To convince you that in astrophysics we can solve classical mechanics problems and publish them. Yeah. And the tack I'll take on this, on these two, is what sorts of things do these phenomena tell us about the state of the interior? Start with glitches. The crab pulsar that Lars just mentioned is an active glitcher, which is about every 5 years or so. These objects are spinning down under the electromagnetic torque that Lars mentioned. So the way these spin irregularities are studied is to look at deviations from the secular spin down. That's what's shown here. This is spin rate versus time. Here it follows a model, and then at t equals zero, something happens. It's suddenly spinning faster than it was before. In this particular glitch, there was some further rise resolved and then a relaxation process subsequently.
What's the factor of difference there in the spin rates? It's hard to tell.
This is fractional change in units of 10 to the 8. This particular jump involved a fractional spin jump then of a part in 10 to the 7, which seems like a small effect, but these effects are enormous compared to the size of effects that the observers can detect. And also, because neutron stars have very large moments of inertia, the angular momentum involved in these events is really huge. So what is this phenomenon? Well, this problem has been around almost as long as pulsars have been known to exist. It's been around for over 30 years now. And generally speaking, it's thought that glitches arise from variable coupling between the star's crust, whose spin rate we observe and is tied to the magnetic field, and the interior liquid. So they're thought to be variable coupling of the crust and core liquid, or crust and interior liquid. And the big question for 30 years has been how and why. Oh, sorry. Yeah, okay. Sorry. No. Left the radio pulsar part. Okay. Well, what sort of processes drive the glitch phenomenon depend on what the star is made of and what the state of the interior is. And I'd like to sketch for you just the current picture of the state of the neutron star interior, which is, a lot has gone into this, a lot of theoretical work, a lot of extrapolation from nuclear physics data, a lot of inferences from observations. But here's the basic picture. They're round, pretty round. Their strong gravitational fields don't allow you to put very large mountains on them, except maybe a millimeter high. And it consists of distinct regions. Outside, there's a solid crust, which is actually not as thick here as I've drawn it. I just need space for the words I'm about to put there. At the crust, there's a crust, which is a Coulomb lattice, and is filled with a neutron liquid, which can flow relatively freely through the lattice. In the core, there's a liquid of neutrons, protons, maybe 10% by mass, enough electrons to maintain charge neutrality, probably also muons come in. At the very core, where we're many times above nuclear density, it's not clear what we have. Well, in the crust, it's thought that through attractive channels of the strong nuclear force, the neutrons pair and condense at temperatures on the order of an MeV into a superfluid. Neutron star cools through an MeV very soon after its birth, weeks or months after it's born. So the neutron liquid in the crust is thought to be superfluid. So we have paired neutrons here.
The lattice is protons or what? Coulomb lattice?
Neutron liquid.
Lattice subatomic nuclei.
I'm sorry, what's the question?
Then Coulomb lattice, so what are the charges? That's what I'm trying to find.
Well, iron-like 50.
Oh.
Iron nuclei.
Iron.
Yeah. So we go iron down to the lighter elements as we go out. Okay. So then in the core, it's thought that the neutrons pair there as well, and also the protons can pair with each other and become superconducting. So here it's thought we have paired neutrons and paired protons. Well, because the neutron liquid is superfluid and is rotating, it should be threaded by vortices. So we expect neutron vortices throughout the star along the star's rotation axis. And for rotation rates of these pulsars, say 100 radians per second, there should be about 10 to the 19 neutron vortices. So the spacings are something like a millimeter or a tenth of a millimeter. The magnetic fields at the surfaces from the spin-down properties are inferred to be 10 to the 12, 10 to the 13 Gauss typically for the radio pulsars, and larger for the higher field objects that Lars mentioned. And so out here, you have a field whose field lines, say we have go from 10 to the 12 Gauss here. There's a field whose field lines penetrate the crust in some way. And if the core is a type 2 superconductor, they would become organized into flux tubes, perhaps, in the core, which might take a very complicated geometry and be tangled up with the vortices. So that's kind of hard to draw, but it might do something like this, and then it comes out like this. Okay. So the vortex lines in the crust experience an attractive interaction with the nuclei, which is on the order of an MeV or a little less per nucleus, which could pin the vortex lines of the crust to the solid there. Similarly, there's an interaction energy between neutron vortices if they attempt to cross proton flux tubes. So it might be possible in the core for the vortex lines there to get tangled up with and effectively pinned to the flux tubes. And that's an idea that's been worked out by Mal Ruderman in the past and also during his visit here at the workshop. There's a couple of models for what's actually going on to drive glitches. In one model, the vortices stick to the nuclei of the crust. The crust gets torqued down by the electromagnetic torque, allowing an angular velocity difference to build up. So the fluid becomes a sort of becomes a reservoir of angular momentum. Then some sort of instability kicks in that allows vortices to unpin catastrophically and move radially outwards, allowing a dissipative coupling between the more rapidly rotating liquid and the solid. And how exactly this occurs with the nature of the instability is been a matter of vigorous debate. So a couple of models are, one is simply unpinning events. And another possibility that's been advanced by Mal Ruderman is that effectively the vortices, as they try to move away from the rotation axis, get hung up against a fence of proton flux tubes. That causes angular momentum to get stored in the core liquid. Eventually, the vortices, as they move outwards, are able to push the field out towards the crust core boundary, creating very high fluxes there. And that the crust, because it's highly conductive, resists the motion of the magnetic field into it. Well, if the vortices push hard enough on the flux tubes, they can create enough stresses to actually crack the crust, allowing the whole vortex array to expand somewhat and take some of the excess angular momentum out of the core and give it to the solid. So that is fracturing of the crust. By the forcing of flux tubes by the neutron vortices against the conductive crust. And estimates of what sort of field strengths would be needed to do that, it definitely seems like this could be relevant physics, that if you push on the field long enough, say over evolutionary timescales, thousands of years for a spinning down object, that eventually something's got to give. And the way it gives could involve fracturing the crust by magnetic stresses. OK, so that's the basic problem, and that's the current confusing theoretical situation. This problem has been around for a long time, but just very recently, there have been some advances on this question, which tell us something about the relevant processes. One is that as more and more glitches occur, it becomes possible to do statistical studies of the angular momentum requirements of glitches. And looking at these statistics, allows one to obtain constraints on what fraction of the star's moment of inertia is involved in this loose screw inside that occasionally gives angular momentum to the crust and spins it up. And doing a statistical study and making some fairly general, reasonable assumptions about the interior suggests that the fraction of the star's moment of inertia that's pinned is always right about 1% in glitching stars. It's quite remarkable how close these estimated numbers are one to one another through the glitching population. This might indicate a crust origin, because the moment of inertia of the neutron superfluid in the crust, where vortex pinning to the nuclei could occur, is estimated to be about 1%. And so it could be that the reason we get about 1% in general for glitching pulsars is that we've run up against a barrier, which is how much liquid you can have in the inner crust. That's suggestive. Another thing that's interesting is that regardless of which of these two possible models you want to consider, this one which is crust-originated glitches and this one which is core-originated glitches, regardless of which process, if either, is responsible for glitches, both of these release about the same amount of energy as heat through dissipation in the coupling. And they both models predict about 10 to the 40 to 10 to the 42 ergs dissipated as heat. So this heat gets laid down. Most of it diffuses to the surface over some time scale and enhances the star's surface emission. The rest of the heat goes inside and eventually radiated away as neutrinos. The characteristics of this thermal wave depend on a couple of or several things. Obviously, the amount of energy that's put down and the depth at which it's done. The equation of state of nuclear matter, and of course, the crust conductivity. All those will influence how long it takes the thermal wave to come out, but simulations of this show something like this. The temperature is whatever it is, and then a glitch occurs, you get heat deposited inside. There's a delay, it slowly diffuses out, so we might have a glitch here, laying down the heat, and you get a peak of the thermal wave weeks or months or even years later. What that delay is depends on these factors, and the enhancement is roughly of order a percent. So that sort of enhancement in surface temperature is detectable now with the present generation of satellites. So it's possible to start looking for this thermal wave in order to obtain diagnostics on the glitch phenomenon.
What's the time scale
again? For the thermal wave to emerge? Weeks, months, years. Yeah. The one of the most actively and violently glitching pulsars known, the Vela pulsar, gave us a really good one in January, which the fractional spin jump was 3 times 10 to the minus 6. Pavlov and company, Pavlov visited this workshop and presented a result on that. They looked for the thermal wave 2 weeks and a month after the glitch and saw nothing. They constrained the temperature increase a month after the glitch to be less than 3/10 of a percent 1 month after a large glitch. Which is truly remarkable. You put something like 10 to the 42 ergs somewhere in the star, and a month later you don't see the temperature go up to within 3/10 of a percent. Well, this non-detection is actually a breakthrough, because it will allow us to constrain these variables concerning the glitch process. How much heat you put down at what depth you put it. Generally speaking, as you put it deeper, it takes longer to get out, and more gets lost as neutrinos. There's some dependence, not so strong, on the detailed equation of state, but probably the thing that'll be the most stringently constrained is just how conductive the crust is. The less conductive it is, the longer it takes for the thermal wave to get out. And theoretical work on this question is underway, but I think this will be a very constraining observation.
They,
I don't know if those guys are looking, because they usually they get one slot of observing time and that's it. But I think one reason they may not have seen it is I think they may have looked too early. It's the enhancement, the peak could be occurring right about now, actually. I don't know if they're looking. No. Probably not. Just it's these target of opportunity programs are hard to get approved. Okay. Right, the second interesting development I want to talk about is what is apparently precession of some sort observed in an isolated pulsar. That's its phone number there. This thing has been monitored regularly for 13 years. This is 3 years of data which were particularly well sampled. Shown here is residual spin rate with respect to gradual slowdown. And they see something that's just extremely nicely harmonic, very, very periodic. The derivative of that, which is a measure presumably of any torques on the star, gives you delta P dot. That's shown here. It's completely equivalent. It's just the derivative. And what these solid curves are fits with sinusoidal components, one with a period of about 500 days and a harmonic of 250 days. And that simple combination of two sinusoids gives curves that pretty well follow the data. There's also evidence for 1,000-day periodicity, but that's extremely difficult to see in this plot. Now, these sorts of, when observers see these sorts of periodicities, they think planets right away, Doppler shifts on the pulsar associated with gravitational interaction with planets. But the real clincher is that they also took data at the same time on the shape of the beam. And they see this is just a measure, it doesn't really matter what it is, of the beam width. So that the beam width is actually small here, it's wide here and narrow here. But they see correlations of the beam width with what the spin data are doing. And that's exactly what you expect if you have precession. If you have precession, the star is wobbling about its angular momentum axis, and the angles with which you look into the pulsar beam vary over the schedule of the precession. And so the fact that it's widening and narrowing correlated with the spin variations is strongly suggestive that we're seeing precession. This would be very hard to explain with planets. Okay. So this is something that's been worked on over the course of this workshop. And one thing that's clear that this is not is free precession. If you take, remember from mechanics, if you take a solid object that has some oblateness and you set it into a state of rotation where it's neither its symmetry axis or angular velocity vector are aligned with the angular momentum, the whole thing wobbles. Well, that will give you timing variations, but in the observed spin rate and its derivative, but the effect is about two orders of magnitude too small. Well, there's no reason to expect it to be free precession anyway. That's just an easier problem to solve. But in fact, these things are spun down by their dipole torques. The dipole torque depends on the angle between the star's rotation axis and the dipole moment. As the body precesses, the angular velocity vector moves through the body, and that angle with respect to the dipole moment changes. That creates torque variations, and what happens in effect is that the torque, the dipole torque, acts to effectively amplify the effects of free precession. That is, you have a sort of quasi-free precession situation that is driving torque changes, which give larger spin rate variations, which are about of the magnitude observed. This it appears that the precession frequency is about 511 days, and that the harmonic at approximately 250 days comes from nonlinear dependence of the torque acting on the star on the angular velocity. All right, so for a precession period of the observed 500 days, that implies an oblateness of the star. That is the difference between the largest and smallest moments of inertia fractionally of 10 to the minus 8. That is, an object with that sort of oblateness would precess with a period of 511 days. It turns out that that sort of oblateness could be supported by crust rigidity. That is, if you take the neutron star crust, if you try to build a mountain on it that's too large, but it's made of rigid material, it'll get broken down by its own weight. There's some maximum mountain that you can have just like on planets. And that maximum mountain is a couple of orders of magnitude larger than the oblateness that's required. So it appears that crust rigidity could be sufficient to maintain this oblateness. How you get it is a different question. Perhaps some sort of violent youth that built up mountains and perturbed the moment of inertia of the star away from its angular momentum axis. But the embarrassing puzzle that's come up is that this precession is completely inconsistent with the notion of vortex pinning that I was describing earlier. And that's really where we are now on this problem, is that the observed precession is badly inconsistent with significant vortex pinning. The reason is that if you have effective vortex pinning, the pinning force exerts forces on the crust that cause it to zoom around its symmetry axis at a much higher rate. And so, in particular, the precession period, if the moment of inertia of the star that's actually pinned is 10 to the minus 2, to take the number 1% that was implied by observations of glitching radio pulsars, this gives a precession period of not several years as observed, but 40 seconds, which is poor agreement even for astrophysics. And so, what does this mean? What are the implications? Well, one possibility is that we simply don't have superfluidity in neutron stars. That's a rather extreme solution. We expect that on fairly general grounds. We also don't want to give up vortex pinning because it appears to satisfy the angular requirements of glitches in radial pulsars. So one way out of this might be that vortex pinning occurs in some objects, the ones that glitch, and for some reason, not in other objects, the ones that are capable of exhibiting long period precession. And right now there's theoretical work underway to look at the possibility that the state of vortex pinning is actually bistable, that it can occur in some situations and not in others. I'm sure I'm way over time, so I'll turn it over to Martin, unless there are any questions.
I'm actually thinking, really what I had to say was sort of an elaboration of Lars's thing. I know that I hate it if a talk goes off more than 50% of the time. So I'll just skip. I mean, I think it really makes no sense. I'd rather free you all and...
No, I think you should go for 10 minutes on
that. That makes no sense. I mean, I'll explain things and then I'll take also 15 or 20 or maybe half an hour if I timed it badly. Or, I mean, you actually, it's a very nice introduction. I think let's just leave it at that. If people have heard my physics club, you have heard half of it anyway. So let's just close here. Let's wait.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.